introduction and for inviting me to speak in today's seminar. In my talk about generating small neutrino masses from gravitational anomaly, I would like to present you a new class of low energy models beyond the standard model, which has very different phenomenological and cosmological consequences than the usually considered high energy models beyond the standard model. And I would like to mainly focus in my talk on our neutrino mass model, because this lays the cornerstone for this new class of models. And I will also briefly talk about the related axion model that we afterwards proposed, and would also like to talk about some recent ideas I'm currently working on right now. And all this work has been done in collaboration with my PhD supervisor, Giad Vali, and we published the first two papers on the archive last year. You all know that the experimental discovery of the milli-electron volt neutrino mass splitting gave rise to one of the greatest mysteries of current theoretical particle physics. So the question is, why are these neutrino masses so extremely small, and what kind of theoretical mechanism generates them? And usually people try to answer this question by going to high energies, to the ultraviolet, for example, in terms of the seesaw mechanisms, in terms of grand unified theories, models with large extra dimensions. And all these models have one feature in common. They all in some form require the Higgs mechanism, and therefore they have to explain the smallness of the neutrino mass scale with respect to the electroweak scale of the neutrino condensate. So they need some kind of beyond standard model mechanism in order to suppress the scale with respect to the electroweak scale. So in the seesaw mechanism, this is done by the large Majorana mass, the right-handed Majorana mass on the gut scale usually. And in models with large extra dimensions, this is done by the tiny overlap of the wave functions of the left-handed neutrino living on the four-dimensional brain and the right-handed neutrino living on the higher dimensional bulk. So what we would like to propose is a different direction of model building by not going to the ultraviolet, but to the infrared sector beyond the standard model. And we're doing this by proposing that the neutrino masses are generated through gravitational anomaly. So we just take the standard model as it is with massless fermions. We don't add any new species or symmetry groups or any extra dimensions. We just take the standard model as it is and couple it to gravity. And what we observed is that non-perturbative gravity can actually give rise to low neutrino masses at a new infrared gravitational scale. And I would like to just briefly summarize the model so that you know what you will expect today. So what we showed is that in the presence of a gravitational theta term, analogous to the theta term in QCD, we would get neutrino condensation and effective neutrino masses at a new infrared scale of gravity. So this is an infrared scale of non-perturbative gravity, which is fixed by phenomenological requirements to be at the scale of dark energy, which is very interesting, we think. And it's a new infrared scale in contrast to the usual high energy scales considered by previous models. So before I would like to present the entire model, I would first like to take a step back and remind you of the neutrino mass problem, which you're all very familiar with. So the fundamental question is, why do we have this huge gap between the neutrino mass scale and the masses of the charged fermions in the standard model? This is widely seen as unnatural, so people suggest that we need some beyond standard model physics, beyond the usual Higgs mechanism, to explain these masses. And as I said before, previous attempts tried to add beyond standard model physics to the standard model. We just take the standard model as it is and couple it to gravity and see that a gravitational theta term can actually give rise to these masses. And in order to give you an intuition for the main theoretical arguments of our paper, I would like to first point out to you the QCD story, the analogous QCD story, where we also know this to happen, and then afterwards explain the gravitational case so that you get some kind of intuition for these arguments. Yeah, so we have this fundamental question of where the neutrino masses come from, and now we are calling QCD for help. So we are trying to find an analogy in the QCD sector and see that we can actually transfer these effects to gravity. In QCD, you're maybe very familiar with these effects. We have a topologically non-trivial vacuum, which spontaneously breaks the chiral quark flavor symmetry. So we have the up, down, and strange quark, which are very light. We can approximate them as being massless. Then we have a U3 left cross U3 right symmetry, which is spontaneously broken by the quark condensate, so that we have a mixing of left-handed and right-handed states, and we get effective neutrino mass, quark masses in the QCD sector. In principle, we would expect to have 8 plus 1 pseudo-goldstones emerging from this effect. But historically, there was this U1 or eta prime puzzle, which is the puzzle that in nature we only observe 8 light pseudo-goldstones, the mesons like pions and kaons and so on. But the 9th meson, the eta prime, is much heavier and cannot be regarded as a pseudo-goldstone. This was historically a puzzle. So we had this U1 symmetry corresponding to these chiral quark rotations, a corresponding current, and this pseudoscalar, which can be written as a quark bilinear in the low energy theory. Here I just wrote for simplicity just one quark flavor, but of course we have all three of them, and I also omitted numerical factors. And now the question was, why isn't this a pseudo-goldstone of this U1 symmetry? And the answer to this question is that the symmetry is not an actual symmetry. It's anomalous. It's spoiled by non-perturbative effects. So we have this anomalous divergence, GD tilde, which on the level of the Lagrangian manifests itself in this famous theta term. So we have this angular parameter theta. We have the gluon field strength and the Hodge dual of the gluon field strength, G tilde. And on the level of the eta prime meson, this gives rise to a huge mass on top of the small mass contribution coming from explicitly breaking this quark symmetry. And this was the resolution to this puzzle, but there's another puzzle in QCD, which you're probably also very familiar with. This theta term gives rise to strong CP violation. So the measure of strong CP violation is this vacuum correlator, which depends on the theta angle, the mass of the quarks, and the quark condensate. And because we don't observe any CP violation in QCD, either this theta parameter has to be extremely small, or one of the quark masses has to be zero, or we just need some new standard, beyond standard model physics. So this is a story which you're probably very well familiar with. I just wanted to repeat it, because we can actually transfer these effects to gravity, which is something new and something not very well known. So there are analogous effects in gravity coupled to the three neutrinos, because the three neutrinos are the lightest fermions in the standard model. They are the analogous, they play the analogous role to the three light quarks in the QCD sector. And in gravity, we also know that we have a theta term. But we don't know if the theta term is physical or not. So that the term exists was computed several decades ago. But we don't know if there are non-perturbative effects which make this term physical, or if it's just, as the QCD theta term, total derivative without any non-perturbative effects, and therefore just a mathematical artifact. So we're starting with this assumption that the gravitational theta term is actually physical, that there are non-perturbative effects, either semi-classical or fully quantum, such as virtual Michael black holes or wormholes, which make this theta term physical. So the theta term reads theta g. So we again have this angular parameter, just as in QCD. And then we have R tilde, where R is the Riemann tensor, and R tilde is the Hodge dual of the Riemann tensor. As I said before, this was computed several decades ago, and it's still an open question whether this term is just a mathematical artifact or is really physical. And we're taking the physicality of this term as an assumption and try to see what kind of consequences this could have for the standard model.
Do you mean by that, so in the QCD case, you mean there are known photons that relate the different physically distinct vacua that come coming from this, and you're saying that in this case there aren't? There are not, people haven't found corresponding explicit solutions that describe different, that relate different vacua corresponding.
Yeah, so in QCD, we know that there are two effects. We have these instanton effects corresponding to tunneling solutions, and Witten and Veneziano showed that there are also contributions from large n QCD would scale like 1 over n and not like exponential minus n. And in the large n limit, these fully quantum effects found by Witten and Veneziano, they're the dominant contribution to the eta prime mass and not the semi-classical instanton solutions. So that's the reason why we're saying, okay, we keep ourselves open-minded and say it could be either semi-classical, so tunneling solutions, or fully quantum effects. And yeah, so there have been many non-perturbative effects found already in gravity, such as virtual microblack holes. But so far, it's still an open question whether they really make this theta term physical. So that's something we can only fully answer if we have a full theory of quantum gravity, including the high energy completion, the UV completion. But for making this assumption, we only need to know the low energy sector. We can fully work in this safe, well understood low energy regime and quantize gravity and couple it to the standard model. But so for proving this assumption, yeah, one would need the entire theory of quantum gravity. Yeah. So we want to, like, the philosophy is to take it like the other way around, to say what kind of consequences would this have? We can observe these consequences, and if we don't observe them, if we falsify the model, then this would show that this gravitational theta term actually can't be physical. So we would learn a lot about quantum gravity from this model building side.
So theta is supposed to be a constant or a field or?
What exactly? You mean,
no, I'm trying
what?
Theta,
okay.
Is that going to be a constant or is that constant?
Yeah, so in QCD, it's a constant. And if we have, for example, axion physics, it's just promoted to a field. And if we have a massless up quark, it's also promoted to a field, to the eta prime field. And we will see later that we have a similar story as the massless up quark solution in the quark sector. So it's, first of all, it's just a parameter. A free parameter could be anything, should be order of one. And if we couple gravity to massless neutrinos, then this will actually be promoted into a dynamical field, which is something I will show to you in a few minutes. Yeah. Okay, so it was shown like 10 years ago by my supervisor Giad Valli and also Jakiv and P, that in case of a theta term in gravity, we can apply these tools we just got from the QCD sector. We can take them and apply them to gravity because they showed that in presence of a theta term generically, the corresponding axial anomaly triggers a mass gap in the theory. So it gives rise to a massive new degree of freedom in the fermionic part of the theory. And this is then a fermionic bilinear, so a new bosonic massive state, and which was then applied a couple of years ago by Dvali, Folkatz, and Franca to the gravitational case coupled to neutrinos. So what they were showing is that in presence of a gravitational theta term that is physical, the axial neutrino anomaly gives rise to a new composite neutrino state, which is analogous to the eta prime meson of QCD, and which is the reason why they called it an eta new particle. So it's analogous in the sense that it gets a huge mass from the anomaly, but in the chiral limit doesn't get any other mass contribution elsewhere. These proofs were based on a topological reformulation of the QCD and gravity sectors. It's called the topological freeform language. If you're interested in that, I can explain it to you later, but I think that would be a bit too long to explain the technicalities right now. So I just want to tell you that this can be proven on a couple of pages. And when I read into these papers, when I started my PhD, I was asking myself if we could actually go one step further, because now we know that a theta term in gravity generates a particle analogous to the eta prime particle. I was asking myself if we could actually also see this condensation and mass generation effect in the neutrino sector, just as we see it in the quark sector. So we have this analogy.
That's good.
Yes.
This might not make sense,
mm-hmm.
but so what is the binding energy that we're considering for this neutrino bilinear? So this is gravitational binding energy, or this is all coming from the electroweak sector, or?
No, it's gravitational. Yeah, so
it's
in QCD, we know that the scale of confinement and the scale of chiral symmetry breaking, they're very close. So people usually think, okay, if we have strong perturbative coupling, this is usually the scale where also the non-perturbative coupling becomes strong. But in the gravity case, this can't be the case, because all the consequences that we show from this non-perturbative gravitational sector, which could make this theta term physical, we will see later that from phenomenological requirements, this has to be a low energy effect. So this has to happen at the millielectron volt to electron volt scale. And therefore, these scales where the non-perturbative effects become strong, it can't be the Planck scale. So if it were the Planck scale, these effects were not allowed to exist. And therefore, here in the gravity case, yeah, we have a separation of scales. But it's not the perturbative coupling which becomes strong at this scale, but just non-perturbative effects. Yes. So this is the difference to QCD. Okay, so as I said, we're now considering the gravitational case. Instead of quarks, now we're considering neutrinos. We have the U3 flavor symmetry in the neutrino sector, a U1 symmetry corresponding U1 current, and this new pseudoscalar degree of freedom. And this gets a huge mass from this anomaly, RR tilde, and some additional mass contribution in case that neutrinos have some explicit hard masses. And now, I asked myself the question if this could also give rise to neutrino condensation. We continued with these computations in this three-form language and actually showed that this vacuum correlator is proportional to an order parameter of chiral neutrino symmetry breaking, which most obviously can be identified with a quark condensate, a neutrino condensate, just as in the quark case. Yeah, so I was very excited when we found this, even though I think for people familiar with topological vacuum susceptibilities, it's nothing new or surprising. At least they told me after I presented them these results. But what is new and surprising is the consequences this has for the neutrino sector. And this is what I would like to show you in the following. First of all, I would like to summarize again how we get to this condensation and what the assumptions are. So as I said, we have these non-perturbative effects. Most likely quantum, could also be just semi-classical. Therefore, we have this physical gravitational theta term, and now we have a new scale in the system, which is analogous to the QCD scale. We call the scale lambda g, and we will later see that due to phenomenological requirements, this has to be an infrared scale, unlike in QCD. So if we couple neutrinos to the gravity sector, then we see that we get neutrino flavor symmetry breaking through the gravitational anomaly, and this corresponds to neutrino condensation at the scale lambda g, and we get therefore new bosons in the neutrino sector. I already talked about this eta prime, or the eta prime analogon, this eta nu. This is a massive new pseudo goldstone, and on top of that, we get additional massless goldstones. And unlike in QCD, we have to break the entire flavor symmetry. So for Dirac neutrinos, it's U3 left plus U3 right. We have to completely break it in order to get a neutrino mass hierarchy and mixing. Therefore, we get 17 additional goldstones. And they are massless and not massive, because we're assuming that neutrinos are massless in the standard model. We only have an effective mass generation, so the symmetry is exact apart from some weak corrections, which are super tiny. So we can say that these goldstones are approximately massless. And then the interesting consequence is that the same non-perturbative coupling, which gives rise to the condensation and to this new bound degree of freedom, also gives rise to effective small neutrino masses. And this is something which is not an additional assumption or so. This is well known from QCD. There it's the Toft vertex, which I depicted here. So this is the vertex. The non-perturbative gravitational interaction, which is then coupling the neutrinos to the condensates, which I indicated as these blue blobs here. And this gives rise to effective neutrino masses coming from the condensate. So now you were perhaps asking yourself, okay, how can we generate a mass hierarchy from it and mixing? Because this is gravity, so it should couple like equally to all the fermions. And the answer to this question is that the mass hierarchy in mixing is determined by the effective potential. So it's a spontaneous symmetry breaking effect. So the mass matrix has to be determined by dynamically determined by minimizing this effective potential with respect to the neutrino bilinear order parameters. And we showed that a very generic structure of this effective potential, which already just includes up to quartic order invariance, gives rise to a very rich structure of flavor symmetry breaking. So we can actually get neutrino masses which are in accordance to what we know from experiments. And another point which is interesting to mention is that this mechanism is actually independent of the Dirac or Majorana nature of neutrinos. So in the previous slides, I considered the Dirac case, but we could also consider the Majorana case, for example, just only left-handed neutrinos, so just the standard model. And then we could generate effective small neutrino masses from the gravitational theta term, simply because we just need this U1 symmetry and the anomaly, which is present in both cases, so in the Dirac and the Majorana case. So we don't actually need to extend the standard model at all for this mechanism to work. Okay, so this is the theoretical setup. Do you have any questions, or shall I proceed to the phenomenological consequences?
So you predict 17 other Goldstone bosons.
Mm-hmm.
These are stable particles, stable bosons that we should see in nature.
Yeah, so the eta prime, because it's massive, it will decay into these lightest ones, but they exist, and they will give a contribution to dark radiation in the late universe, for example. Yes, but this is also something I will now talk about in the phenomenological section. The reason why we can't observe them is because usually in all the high-energy processes which we observe, all these bosons, they are coupled to, for example, neutrinos with this low-energy vertex, which melts at any high-energy process. So as soon as we have a large momentum transfer, the interaction melts. And they have a very low compositeness scale. So they will melt away in all, for example, astrophysical environments. So they won't contribute to star cooling and will evade all these usual bounds which are there on the presence of such bosons. Yeah. Okay, then if there are no other questions, I will proceed to the phenomenological bounds which exist on the symmetry breaking scale lambda g. And for simplicity, I will assume for a second that the scale of the condensate equals the scale of chiral symmetry breaking and equals the temperature in the universe where this phase transition happens. We know from QCD that they can be parametrically different, but for a second, let me, for simplicity, just assume this to illustrate the rough bounds which exist on the symmetry breaking scale. So first of all, we have a neutrino-independent bound that the scale has to be much smaller than the QCD scale, because this gravitational theta term will, of course, also affect the other fermions in the standard model, not only the neutrinos. So we will get a contribution from gravity into other fermionic condensates, for example, the quark condensate. And this will enter the Higgs condensate and therefore the electroweak effect of W and Z boson mass generation. And this has to be strongly suppressed with respect to the QCD scale. Then we have an upper bound coming from cosmology, because we have very strong free streaming constraints on neutrinos coming from the early universe. Because our model predicts strong neutrino-neutrino interactions for energies below the symmetry breaking scale, the phase transition can actually only happen after photon decoupling, so after the time of CMB formation, which is at a temperature of about 250 millielectron volt. Then we have a lower bound coming from neutrino mass splitting, because we know that the heaviest neutrino at least has a mass of 50 millielectron volt. So if we consider the maximal coupling of 4 pi to the condensate, then we see that the scale at least has to be 4 millielectron volt large. And then in addition to these neutrino-dependent constraints, there are also neutrino-independent constraints. For example, this entire infrared region here is ruled out because of modifications to Newtonian gravity that we would expect. So we can't make a prediction how the susceptibility enters the graviton propagator, but there should be some observable effects. And these measurements of Newtonian gravity, the precision actually is exactly at the millielectron volt scale, so it has been probed precisely up to the scale. So these effects shouldn't happen at a lower scale. And this upper bound is also independent of the neutrino mass generation mechanism, because even if neutrinos get masses from somewhere else, they will nevertheless condense in the late universe, because these effects also happen if neutrinos have hard masses coming from somewhere else. And then we have again these free streaming constraints.
Mm-hmm. So when you say free streaming constraint, it's more the collision of the electrons. This is the interaction which counts for a long because you decouple from each other and you make.
Yeah. So yeah, so there.
I don't think that it's much frustrating from the neutrinos because the sticker ball from the interaction is very large and it's a typical problem. The interaction is very large, but the decoupling, the neutrino-neutrino decoupling will happen late. So what really breaks the fluctuations is the collisions, it's not the frustration.
Okay, but we were not allowed to have any new interactions in the early universe which would modify this.
So what is the cross section?
So the neutrino-neutrino interactions are mediated by these new bosons which have masses like the eta prime, for example, of like milli electron volt or electron volt. Yeah, this is a very large cross section. So they will be strongly coupled in the late universe. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's conditional density.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is what I meant.
In the ordinary case, neutrinos decouple at whatever PVM.
Yeah, but then the decoupling is much later, but what breaks the fluctuation to the conditional because the cross section is large.
And
this training starts very late, from what I understand. The decoupling, they become free at whatever 256 MeV, which is very late. So they don't have time to frustrate because it starts at 256 MeV till structure formation. But instead of starting at MeV.
But the decoupling should be in the standard model, should be earlier. And then at 250 MeV, it's like for the photons, the decoupling temperature. Yeah. And after this transition, then you will have a strongly coupled like neutrino fluid. They will also annihilate, and all this stuff is excluded for phase transitions before photon decoupling. Yeah. So what we see here is that the scale lambda g, and therefore also this neutrino vacuum condensate, is actually at the scale of dark energy. So the dark energy density is approximately milli electron volt to the power of 4. And so we see here a numerical coincidence. And of course, we can't draw any precise conclusions from that because we don't know why the other standard model condensates don't contribute into dark energy. But the only thing we can say is that our neutrino condensate is the only one which is generated through gravitational effects and is also tied to this new gravitational scale in the system. So it may be that this could somehow explain this small energy density. And it might be that it just emerges in the late universe after this phase transition. But this is just a very, very broad idea or conjecture. We can't really theoretically justify this. Okay, so these are the bounds. As I said, they are actually model independent in the sense that they don't, they're not constructed for generating neutrino masses, but we see like from gravity and from cosmology, this scale has to be in this low energy range, and for all the other ranges, it is actually ruled out. This is very interesting, and it leads to many interesting phenomenological consequences, where I think the most important one is the fact that the neutrino mass bounds from cosmology, they become invalid. This is because the relic neutrinos are massless in the early universe, and they only gain their masses in the late universe after this phase transition at the temperature, which is approximately equal or lower to the symmetry breaking scale. And after this transition, the neutrinos will decay, because we have enhanced neutrino decay of heavier into lighter neutrinos by emitting one of these massless bosons. So all the neutrinos, the relic ones, will be in the lightest mass eigenstate after the transition. And then, depending on the exact parameters in the theories, like lambda g or the neutrino masses, which are parameters we don't know yet precisely, depending on these parameters, the relic neutrinos will either bind up or form a superfluid, and they will partially or perhaps even completely annihilate, so that in our today's universe, it might be that we don't even have any relic neutrinos anymore. So this is the most natural case. The largest part of the parameter space predicts that neutrinos, the relic neutrinos, have completely annihilated until today. So we see that the bound of on the sum of the neutrino masses becomes invalid. Usually this is stated to be around 0.2 electron volt. And that this is invalid is, I think, very exciting. So I got very excited when I realized this, because now the only bounds which are with certainty constraining the absolute neutrino mass scale are terrestrial experiments, so beta decay experiments, and the bounds are still very weak. So the neutrino masses could be still super electron volt masses. The current constraints are at about 2 electron volt. And this means that the next generation beta decay experiments, such as the Katrin experiment, could actually detect relatively large neutrino masses, which would otherwise stand in conflict with cosmology. And as soon as we, as long as we assume that the lambda CDM model is really valid, there is actually no other model which could evade such constraints on so huge neutrino masses from cosmology. So this would be very exciting if, for example, the Katrin experiment next year would measure such high neutrino masses which could otherwise not be explained.
And these new degrees of freedom, they don't change the double beta decay processes, or
So they won't change the beta decay process. With a double beta decay, we were considering if this changes the decay rate or something, because usually if you have majorons, for example, they will change the double beta decay rate. But you have a very huge momentum transfer in these processes. So their double beta decay is like at 100 MeV squared. And at these off-shell, high off-shell energies, all the vertices to these infrared bosons, they will melt away. So you can't see them in the neutrino-less double beta decay. And we were making some computations if perhaps like the Majorana mass could melt away itself or something. That was an idea that we had, but I think this won't happen. So if you compute the decay, it is actually still the same as in the standard case.
So are you saying that the neutrino can decay to those 3 degrees of freedom? And that would be, given what you said before, the decay rate would be pretty large.
Mm-hmm.
So have you checked, maybe you mentioned that, but I was wondering, have you checked whether, in principle, that would let some signature, because you could also, depending on the exact process, you may have some photon emission, maybe,
mm-hmm.
unless it's all neutral. Have you checked?
I will talk about something related later. So these new bosons, they will have a coupling to the photons via this gravitational vertex and intermediate charge lepton loops. Yeah, and that's a very interesting part, because this will lead to signals in axion-like experiments, in like shining light through walls experiments, where we have photon axion conversion and then photon again through the wall, and this effective interaction actually mimics coupling strength to photons of standard hidden axions with a decay constant of 10 to the 10 GeV roughly. So this is something actually at the current bound of sensitivity, and it would already be ruled out by astrophysics, but the astrophysical constraints, they don't apply to our model. So that's very interesting, because now astrophysics could actually lower these bounds continuously, but we could observe something in like shining light through walls experiments. And this usual correlation of these experiments, it doesn't hold true anymore, because the astrophysical constraints are evaded, but the like other experiments are not. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So in the cosmological, concerning the cosmological part, after I realized that this evades these neutrino mass bounds, I started wondering if our model could actually, on top of that, resolve some cosmological discrepancies that we have been recently observing, or at least during the past years. You're probably all very familiar with it, that there are some tensions, for example, for the Hubble parameter or for the Sigma 8 parameter from different data sets, for example, the Planck and the KITS data sets. And the question is, some people think, okay, maybe just a systematic error. So nobody knows if it might be new physics, but if it's new physics, the question is if it is actually showing some late time modification of cosmology. So we were considering the possibility that perhaps these late neutrino masses and the late self interactions could somehow weaken these tensions. And there was a study done by Cooks, Bang, and Hannestad. They actually scooped us partially, so that was not wasn't too good, but now we're collaborating with them. So now we're they just considered the simple part of our model, so just neutrino masses and self-interactions in the late universe, but they didn't consider the full model, so that's now what we're currently working on, to simulate the full model, the CMB power spectrum, the matter power spectrum, to see what this actually changes in late cosmology, and we will compare it to these different data sets and see if some tensions are reduced. So the full extended possible solution would also include this neutrino annihilation, which we naturally would expect, and some extra dark matter and dark radiation coming from topological defects. Because we're breaking in the late universe this neutrino flavor symmetry, U3 cross U3, so that's a huge symmetry group. We're completely breaking it, so we get a lot of different topological defects, like skirmions and a complicated network of domain walls and strings and global monopoles. And this network, for example, will annihilate very fastly into dark radiation, and these skirmions, they are longer lived, so they would contribute to dark matter in the late universe. And that's something we will also incorporate in these numerical simulations. And one interesting point here to mention is that this phase transition could also be delayed. So it doesn't need to happen instantaneously, but we know from, for example, inflationary scenarios that phase transitions, they can be supercooled. So we could actually have a large energy density fraction of dark matter, for example, in the late universe, even though in the neutrino sector we wouldn't expect so much dark energy or dark matter or dark radiation to emerge. But it could actually be due to this delayed transition that because this energy is frozen in the vacuum due to the supercooling, that we can actually populate the late universe with a huge number of these defects. And this is something we're currently investigating. Okay. Other consequences for the relic neutrinos are that they are clustering because of these additional self-interactions. So we have additional clustering, and that's something I'm trying to simulate now. That's the plan. I recently started another collaboration with a cosmologist from the Max Planck Institute for Astrophysics. We try to see whether this enhanced clustering could lead to such a huge overdensity that we might already detect these relic neutrinos at Catrine, so this is very, very optimistic. So we would need a huge overdensity to accomplish that. But at least it will be relevant for the Ptolemy experiment, which will start in, I don't know, a couple of decades, hopefully. Another?
Sorry. Hmm? So when you say that there's enhanced clustering,
mm-hmm.
what do you mean by that? I mean, actually, the power spectrum of neutrino, you're saying, has some different feature, on small scales.
Yeah, so we have already this gravitational clustering a little bit, but this just gives a very small overdensity. And the idea is now if we have some additional neutrino-neutrino interactions, that this clustering might become stronger in the local environment with the galaxy around. But I'm not really sure if it could be really strong, if it would be also locally at Earth, or if we just have clumps moving around and it could just pass the Earth. I'm not really sure how this clustering would actually look like, but this is something we will now investigate these simulations. Yeah?
The self-interaction with dark matter, for example, would tend to make pressure and you push, you would basically reduce the number density.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually not sure why you said it would lead to an over density and not an under density.
So you mean locally at Earth, like the dark matter density would be?
Where would you expect the concentration of neutrinos? The concentration is large enough, then the interaction rate becomes large.
Mm-hmm.
And then you tend to decrease it basically by pushing the particles away because they diffuse. They basically scatter.
Oh.
You're saying if the extra interactions give a pressure to the neutrinos.
Yeah, it may be that we actually don't get an overdensity, but instead diffuse it. Yeah, I wasn't so this was just the idea. I don't know.
You already have pressure.
You already have high pressure due to their thermal velocity. So why would self interactions further? So I'm not following.
No, I'm not saying that the self interaction are further items, but I'm saying that the interaction rate, the fact that they self interact,
right.
tend to decrease the number density because they would spread out.
But if you have an attractive self-interaction,
well,
it's yeah. I mean, the self-interaction is attractive. Yeah, yeah. So, okay. Yeah, yeah. It may be also that there are some new effects coming out of the simulations we haven't considered yet. That there is some scattering out as well. But yeah. Yeah. Okay.
They're attractive, but they're very short range.
I mean, we have these we have the Maathlos mu bosons in the theory, so should be long range as well. Yeah. So both on top of it, because we have this eta nu and these lighter ones. Yeah. But only at energy scales very low, for example, at the radic neutrino.
The coupling, leads to a force stronger or weaker than gravity. Times 17.
So it doesn't stand in conflict with long-range gravitational measurements.
Bodies of neutrinos to. There's nothing to constrain because we don't have clumps of neutrinos that we can.
The question would be if there are constraints from coupling to electrons and everything. So that would be a good question if they could via loops be in conflict with long-range gravity measurements. But this is not the case. So it's
2-to-2 scattering, and I calculate the potential. Does that give a rise to a force that's stronger or weaker than gravity?
You mean like now neutrino interactions? Yeah, they will be much stronger than gravity at this scale. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Okay. Just one more question: the dark matter parameter, is it decreased with respect to the CDN, or because now you have increased the neutrino mass, so
the interesting point is now that it's not constant over the entire universe anymore. So in the beginning, we have just dark radiation in the neutrino sector, and then in the late universe, you will have additional dark matter from the neutrino sector, but the neutrinos are actually again decaying and annihilating into dark radiation. So we will actually, even in the late universe, it will still be dark radiation. So there's like an intermediate phase in which we have an increase of dark matter, but then again dark radiation. And the only dark matter contribution we can predict in our model is this contribution from the topological defects, from the skirmions, because they can be much longer lived. But so they will also annihilate into these Maathlos bosons. So
in a cluster of galaxies where you have lots of neutrinos, you have a strong interaction there, which tends to gather them together. Do you still have as much dark matter as from the CDN, or do you feel it? I'm confused.
So the dark matter density. It shouldn't be a huge contribution to the dark matter density, because we know from the early universe it should already be there, which is something our model can't account for. So because most of the dark matter we get in our model is annihilating into dark energy, there shouldn't be a huge contribution to that. So the main contribution is actually this dark radiation, and the dark matter component will probably be just a very small one. Yeah.
What's the effective mass for a skirmion?
It's at the scale of lambda g, so it's maybe like electron volt masses, and the energy density they're produced with an energy density given by this inverse correlation length to the power of 4, which is given also by this lambda g scale. So it's actually a very huge density which is produced there, because this is of the order of the dark energy density, which if we have it immediately after the CMB formation, the phase transition would be very small, negligible. But if we have it very recently, it could be a huge increase in energy density that we get. Okay, apart from the relic neutrinos, one interesting aspect is also arising in our model for sterile neutrinos. You may all know that we have these short baseline anomalies in experiments, in neutrino experiments, different anomalies which may also be due to the lack of knowledge of nuclear physics, but it also means new physics effects. And in case we have sterile neutrinos which resolve these anomalies, we don't have any cosmological conflicts, which is usually the case for light sterile neutrinos, because they stand in conflict with the radiation energy density in the early universe and with the neutrino mass bounds from cosmology. But because the neutrinos are masses in the early universe, the sterile neutrinos are completely decoupled from the standard model, so they don't get produced in the early universe. And these mass bounds, they are evaded anyway. So we won't have any conflicts with cosmology, but could naturally resolve these anomalies. For astrophysical neutrinos, these enhanced neutrino decays become important. For example, at IceCube, we measure long-traveling extraterrestrial neutrino fluxes. And if we don't know anything about the source of these neutrinos, we would expect just an equal flavor rate, naively. But if we have neutrino decay on the way to Earth, then we would have a very distinct flavor composition of these neutrinos arriving at Earth. And so this means that IceCube could eventually falsify the model. Because if IceCube rules out neutrino decay, then because neutrino decay is one of the strongest predictions of our model, this would imply that we shouldn't have any condensation and any new bosons in the neutrino sector. Another point for astrophysical neutrinos is that these decays, of course, also modify supernova neutrino spectra. So the supernova neutrinos are decaying on their way to Earth, so we have to modify this. The original neutrino spectra, which we usually infer from the neutrinos we measure at Earth. So if these decays are confirmed, we should have to change that. Okay, so the last slide of the phenomenological consequences. By the way, how much time do I have? Okay, yeah, so 10 minutes left. I think that should be okay. Yeah. the last slide of the phenomenological consequences focuses first on gravity measurements. One interesting aspect is that our model predicts tiny differences in the polarization intensities of gravitational waves. Unfortunately, this is beyond experimental sensitivity currently, so we can't test this prediction, but it's conceptually very interesting because our model is a specific case of dynamical Chern-Simons modified gravity, which was originally proposed by Jakub and P in 2003, and it's a very active research area at the moment. So conceptually, it's very interesting that our model fits into these new class of gravity models. And one prediction which is actually at the frontier of current gravity measurements is that we get a new gravity competing force in short distance measurements. This is something we predicted in our second paper in this domestic axion solution paper to the strong CP problem. There, we're just making one tiny little step further. And in this paper, we are assuming that not only the neutrino mass is generated through these gravitational mechanisms, but also the up quark mass is generated through these effects. And in this case, this eta prime meson mixes with the eta nu boson from the neutrino sector. They mix, and they generate an axion and a gravitational axion. And this renders the strong CP problem. It solves it. It renders the QCD and the gravitational theta terms unphysical. And this then generates a new gravity competing force among the nucleons, and it's isotope dependent because it depends on the coupling to the quarks and other particles which get mass contributions to gravity. So this is a very distinct experimental signature we could see in those experiments, and it's exactly at the current bound of experimental sensitivity.
Yeah? So for the gravitational waves, you basically have the neutrino condensates like a birefringent material that's gonna Faraday rotate polarization, whatever that means for a spin too.
The reason why these intensities are modified is that if you add a theta term to gravity, and this theta becomes promoted into a dynamical field, which is the case in our scenario because it becomes promoted to this eta nu field. Yeah. Then, of course, this was shown. This is exactly Chern-Simons modified gravity, so this RR tilde coupled to a dynamical field. And this when then gravitational waves will propagate through this background of eta nu, then this will cause birefringence for the gravitational waves.
Change the propagation speed?
No, there's no. That's very interesting, yeah. So there's no CP violation by the gravitational vacuum, because this eta nu is kind of the gravitational axion, which renders that unphysical. But in this out-of-vacuum process of gravitational waves, you have different polarization intensities, but still traveling at the speed of light. So this is what Jakub and P showed, and which is very interesting and makes it like phenomenologically viable. So, then one thing I already mentioned is the shining light through walls experiments. And the last part is that because gravity also contributes to other fermion masses, and these masses do not necessarily be aligned with the masses coming from Higgs or from the QCD condensate, we will get off-diagonal masses. We expect these to arise, and they will trigger flavor-violating processes, And we're currently examining if they are at the reach of, in the reach of LHC or upcoming experiments like Mu2E. And yeah, just generally interesting to see that also flyer-violating effects can come from infrared physics and not only ultraviolet physics as it's usually considered. Okay, so this brings me to my summary of this model. We had this one single assumption that we have this physical gravitational theta term, and then we showed on the theoretical side that this yields neutrino condensation and effective neutrino masses, which are independent of the usual Higgs or seesaw or whatever mechanisms which are out there on the market. And we showed that this works both for Dirac and Majorana neutrinos. And on the phenological side, just as a couple of examples to remind you, that we have this neutrino condensate, which is generated at this mu lambda g scale, which is coincident numerically with the scale of dark energy. And the neutrino mass bounds from cosmology are evaded, so we could still have large neutrino masses not in conflict with cosmology. And we also have enhanced neutrino decays and several other signatures, which could be probed in the future with Katrin and IceCube and also cosmological surveys, which are upcoming. Okay, so I would like to now give you a brief overview of what I'm currently working on. So a little outlook on what we can learn, how we can further proceed from this new low energy direction of model building, both for particle physics and for cosmology. And on the particle physics side, I have currently a project in collaboration with my supervisor, Giyad Vali. We are working, as I already mentioned, on this flavor violating aspect of these models coming from deep infrared. We try to generalize it and try to see how relevant it will be in experiments in the future. Then I have a project in cooperation with Misha Schiffmann and Arkady Weinstein, because we are trying to extend this low energy frontier to models beyond gravity. We try to see, for example, in the weak sector, either in the standard model or, for example, in grand unified theories like SU5 or SO10, we might also get non-perturbative effects on low energy scales, which could be important for neutrino masses or for the strong CP problem. And we're trying to investigate several different scenarios. Are currently also working on gauge flavor theories and hope that they will find something very interesting there also then for cosmology. On the cosmological side, as I already mentioned, I'm examining these topological defects that are formed in the late phase transition. That's a project in collaboration with Alex Vilenkin. It's nearly done, so we know how these are formed and entangled and how they evolve. And these results are very important for another project I also already mentioned with the cosmologists Christiane Lorenz, Emilia Calabrese, and Steen Hannestad from Oxford and Aarhus. They are partly part of the Planck collaboration, and we are now investigating numerically whether these cosmological discrepancies could be resolved by our late phase transition. And the last project I also already mentioned in collaboration with Leila Mirzagholi from the Max Planck Institute for Astrophysics is precisely this possible relic neutrino clustering and how important it will be for beta decay experiments and for capturing possibly the relic neutrinos on the radioactive nuclei. So that brings me finally, after I already summarized and showed you an outlook, to a general message, which I find very interesting and which is valid even beyond the specific neutrino mass and axion models and beyond the gravitational assumption that we make, namely that possible resolutions to standard model puzzles cannot only hide in the ultraviolet, but also in the infrared. So usually the tools we use in order to solve these puzzles, like the neutrino mass or axion problems, is we go to the ultraviolet, as I mentioned in the beginning, seesaw mechanisms, grand unified theories. Then we see that the new physics effects are suppressed because of high energy scales. And this also gives small neutrino, for example, masses, axion masses. But we could also have a different direction. We could go into the infrared, and the neutrino mass and axion models are two specific examples. And what we see is that these effects can actually hide as efficiently as for the ultraviolet models. And this was a huge surprise for us, that this is not in conflict with current experiments. It's actually as the ultraviolet effects quite close to current experimental sensitivity, just because all these vertices are melting in high energy interactions. So this is the general message, that I think this new direction of model building is quite interesting and crucial for phenomenology and cosmology, and especially interesting in the in respect to the fact that we don't see any protons decay, we don't see any supersymmetric particles at LHC, so we have this huge trouble that, you know, the ultraviolet models at the moment, the predictions, we don't see anything, so it may be interesting to go into another direction and see if that could work out as well. Okay, so thank you very much for listening, and if you have any questions, you can ask me now or come to my office. I will be here until Wednesday evening. My office is 334. Yeah. And so you can just come around and we can have a chat. Thank you.
All right. I would just add that that because the Bistro is not open tonight, why don't we have speaker lunch and speaker dinner, and so have your lunch paid for by the cosmology.
Okay. Okay. Yes?
Can you explain how this late time phase transition addresses the H-naught discrepancy?
So the H-naught discrepancy, that's something they examined it. So let me go back to this slide. Yeah, here. So in this paper here, by these researchers from Aarhus, they addressed the H-naught problem and said, okay, actually, strong neutrino self interactions are slightly making the problem stronger, but so as far as I know at the moment, it may be that there are new papers on that, and I don't really know if they modify these conclusions, but the H-naught problem might be resolved by increasing the energy density in the late universe, and this would be something which would be generated by our model. So this is the idea that just the local Hubble constant is larger than the one we infer, for example, from CMB measurements, just because the energy density is increasing in the late universe, and we might have an additional contribution to the vacuum energy density at a late universe phase transition. But this is something we still have to test right now, if this is possible or not.
I would have guessed you'd subtract, given what you told me about the decay of the neutrinos. How do you add energy density? Relatively speaking to the matter density that we measure at the times.
So
if I just turn something into matter, I guess that's is that what you're saying?
So I already mentioned that we could easily have a delay of the phase transition, and therefore we have in the beginning just massless neutrinos, and because they're like immediately decaying after the transition and annihilating, like the energy density just in this neutrino sector would probably stay the same, but due to the supercooling, we could have a huge density of these topological defects that are formed. And this is a way how we could actually increase the energy density in the late universe, just because it's frozen in the vacuum for the time of supercooling in this delayed phase transition.
So you can turn vacuum energy into matter density through the creation of the topological.
Yes, exactly. And this could work very easily, so we don't need to tune parameters strongly or something. It very easily could be delayed and then, we would have a huge density, for example, in skirmions, which would be dark matter, or also still in vacuum energy in form of this neutrino condensate. Yeah.
That's developed, I guess, pretty recently.
Yes, so I think that would be redshift 0.8, I think. Yeah. So, of course, then we couldn't explain dark energy with it, because that already has to exist at like z = 5, approximately. So, we can't solve all these problems. So we're just currently trying to see if we numerically simulated what constraints are, what best fits are there for the time of phase transition. Yeah, could be very recently. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
You have these 17. You have this complicated phase transition effective potential, I guess. Could it be that there's a multi-stage phase transition? The observed mass is one stage has completed, which is reflected in the observed masses that we do see.
Sorry, I can't.
Oh, I don't know. Maybe this idea is too
No, no, it's a good idea. So do you mean that you have like the U3 in the beginning, and we like first break it to U1, and then like after some time it's further broken to Zn,
yeah,
and
so
then to U1.
Tone,
yeah, so
maybe just break part way to give the current observed neutrino masses, you attribute the dark energy to the unbroken component, to something.
Yeah.
So
we know that in the end, the entire symmetry has to be broken for the mass hierarchy and the mixing.
It has to be already today.
Yeah. So it can't be that we're in an intermediate stage at the moment. Yeah. So in principle, it can be that parts of the transition happen a bit earlier than later, but we would naturally expect, like in QCD, the chiral symmetry breaking phase transition that happens immediately. We don't have like just first U3 axial broken to U1 axial, and then we wait a bit, and then it's completely broken. So usually it happens like at one time. Yeah.
Is anything known about the nature of what just happened? Is it first order, second order, or whatever you want?
Yeah, already in QCD, that's not known if it's first order or second order. So no, I can't say anything about that. Yeah. Mm.
You said it already, I think, that in the sun, where you have a high density of neutrinos, what would be the effect of the stronger interactions, the self interactions?
So in such high energetic and hot environments like the sun or in supernovae or whatever, we would have all the processes would have a very large momentum transfer. So the interactions to these bosons, they would melt away in such high interactions. Of course, the masses would not, because the oscillation is a low energy effect. But so the masses would actually, in the core of a supernovae, when we have a thermal equilibrium of the neutrinos, we could actually have zero neutrino masses. So like the back phase transition. But in astrophysical environments like the sun, there shouldn't be any enhancement.
In the last
surface,
basically,
mm-hmm.
We don't prevent them to escape. We can still escape.
Surface of last scattering. You mean at CMB formation or?
No, in the sun.
Ah. Oh,
last,
sorry. Okay.
Shell,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 So this is unaltered because this is not altered. So it stays the same as in the standard case, because all the new interactions we have at high energies we can't observe them. So also in high energetic neutrino experiments or like atmospheric neutrinos, these are all also high energetic and so large momentum transfer that the vertices will be suppressed actually by some powers of the symmetry breaking scale divided by the energy. So this is a huge suppression effect. Yeah.
But you also mentioned so the spectra of neutrinos from supernovae could be modified.
Yeah.
So why is that happening?
Because of the decay. It's not because in the supernova process something changes, but when the neutrinos travel from the supernova to the Earth, that's a huge distance, and there they will decay on their way to Earth. So this is similar to what IceCube measures, the astrophysical neutrinos. They travel a huge distance, and they're decaying into the lightest mass eigenstate. And the only bounds which we have on this decay are from solar neutrinos, because we know they're not decaying, but the bounds are very weak because they are so fast that we have such a huge Lorentz boost that the constraints are super weak, but the decays should be strong enough because the coupling should be of order one of the bosons to the neutrinos, that for very long traveling neutrinos, they should have all decayed. Yeah. Okay. So, are there any more questions? I don't think so. Okay, so thank you very much again. And we will have lunch together now, I think.